Buenos días a todas, a todos, a nombre de la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, les damos la bienvenida a la presente audiencia relacionada con el caso promovido por Kulkuminum Treaty Group de Canadá. Me acompaña en esta mesa el comisionado vicepresidente Rodrigo Escobar Gil y apreciamos la presencia tanto de las y los representantes del grupo peticionario, así como de la digna delegación del ilustre Estado del Canadá. La audiencia tiene por objeto recibir información actualizada sobre la situación del caso de las tierras involucradas con miras a tener mayores elementos de juicio para la adopción de un informe de fondo. Tiene la palabra la digna representación de los peticionarios, en el entendido que se está incorporando con nosotros a esta audiencia el comisionado decano Paulo Sergio Piñeiro. Tienen el uso de la palabra por 20 minutos.
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. President. I want to introduce the six chiefs and representatives from the Kulkuminum First Nation members of HTG, all in attendance at this hearing today. Chief Lydia Whitsum, Cowichan Tribes. Chief Richard Thomas, Liaxin First Nation. Chief Cyril Livingstone, Lake Cowichan First Nation. George Seymour, Counselor for Chief John Elliott, Zemina's First Nation, Myris James for Chief Earl Jack, Penelicut Tribe, and John August, Counselor for Chief James Thomas, Hulalt First Nation. Robert Morales, Chief Negotiator for HTG and a member of the Cowichan Tribes, is also in attendance. Representatives and dignitaries from the 14 First Nations organizations and NGOs that have filed amicus briefs in this case are also in attendance at this hearing today. Those in attendance include Chief Doug White from the First Nations Summit, who's also Chief of the Nanaimo Tribe First Nation. Jody Wilson, British Columbia Assembly of First Nations representative, is the regional chief for both the regional AFN and represents the National Assembly of First Nations. Craig Benjamin is from Amnesty International, which has filed an amicus brief on our behalf, as has Lawyers Rights Watch, represented by Heather Noon. Tim Raybould from West Bank First Nation is also an amici in this case, and he's representing Chief Robert Lowy. HTG's arguments, evidence, and allegations have been extensively documented in the submissions provided to the Commission in this case. This morning, I will present the key facts and outline the specific violations of the American Declaration alleged against Canada by HTG. HTG's witness, Luz Chiem, will then give testimony describing the ongoing and irreparable nature of the harms to the Kulkuminum Indigenous Peoples' territories caused by Canada's present-day violations of the Declaration in failing to secure and safeguard their rights in their ancestral lands. I'll conclude with a brief summary of HTG's principal arguments on the merits of the case and outline our specific requests for relief. The chiefs have requested me to respectfully ask if Luz Chiem might be allowed to open with a short prayer according to Kulkuminum customs and traditions. Thank you.
Hisatiam Farmen Hydratnachel Square. Now it is Nash Kisses the size squalted Nagwea. In Kshirti, Ruin Stanishi Mental Hydratum Sea.
Thank you. Thank you. To the Honorable Commissioners, this is a simple case. It is uncontested that the Holkaminam peoples have lived, subsisted, and worshipped upon their ancestral lands, located in British Columbia since time immemorial. HTG has presented extensive evidence, uncontested by Canada, that the Holkaminam continue to rely upon and utilize these lands for their cultural survival, identity, and integrity today. What is also not disputed in this case is that Canada granted most of this land, some 237,000 hectares, to a private railway corporation in 1884, and that the Holkaminam have never been offered restitution for the expropriation of virtually their entire traditional territory by the state. But, contrary to Canada's assertions, HTG wishes to stress that this case is not about an historic taking, to quote Canada's submission, that occurred in the 1800s. The Holkaminam are not asking the Commission to turn back the clock and investigate alleged past wrongs committed against them long ago, prior to the assumption by Canada of its obligations under the OAS Charter and the American Declaration in 1990. This case is about the undisputed fact that today, in 2011, the 6,600 members of the six Holkaminam First Nations are engaged in a desperate struggle for the protection of their human rights and cultural survival as Indigenous peoples living upon their ancestral lands. Their territory, their special relationship to their lands, their culture, and their way of life is being rapidly destroyed by the clear-cutting, deforestation, and real estate development activities of three powerful and politically well-connected forestry corporations, Timber West Forest Corporation, Hancock Timber Resources Group, and Island Timberlands, which I'll be referring to as the Big Three in this hearing. This map, prepared for the purposes of this hearing, which is also included in our presentation summary as Exhibit 1, shows that these three companies claim exclusive ownership and control over nearly 190,000 hectares, or two-thirds of the Holkaminam people's ancestral territory on Vancouver Island, expropriated by the government without compensation. The ongoing destruction, unregulated clear-cutting of the forest, and irreparable harm to the ecosystems, waters, and resources on Holkaminam ancestral lands has been thoroughly documented by extensive submissions, photographic and videographic evidence, affidavits, and other evidence. HTG has also extensively documented that the Holkaminam Indigenous peoples continue to rely upon these lands today, their waters and their resources, for their cultural integrity, identity, and survival, despite their designation as private lands by the state. Our petition charges Canada with failing to secure and safeguard the Holkaminam people's property and other human rights in these ancestral lands in violation of Article 23, the right to property, and other articles of the Declaration. We allege that these violations arise due to the state's failures, ongoing failures, despite repeated requests to demarcate, delimit, and establish boundaries and record the title of the Holkaminam to Indigenous peoples to their ancestral lands controlled by the Big Three, or to provide restitution, as required by the jurisprudence of this commission, for the plundering and confiscation of the Holkaminam ancestral lands. Canada is also charged with failing to engage in any effective consultations with the Holkaminam or to obtain their prior consent as required by the jurisprudence of this commission regarding the wanton and unregulated destruction of their lands, forest, and waters by the Big Three corporations. Canada also refuses to discuss benefit sharing with the Holkaminam for the value of the timber and other resources taken from so-called private lands. We have asked Holkaminam elder and medicine person Luce Cheem to give testimony on the destruction and irreparable harms caused by the clear-cutting and real estate development activities presently occurring on Holkaminam ancestral lands controlled by those three corporations, and the effects of these activities on Holkaminam spiritual, cultural, and subsistence practices conducted on their ancestral lands. I'll turn the speaker over, the microphone over to Luce Cheem.
RCM. I am Luce Cheem, a Selkwan, an elder, speaking on behalf of the six members of the Holkaminam Treaty Group. Elders are the knowledge keepers of our communities. Being an elder is a responsibility and an obligation to speak for our communities. We learn from elders about our territories. Mok stemit natamo, o Mok stem That is, everything on this earth is connected. Everything is what sustains us. I know where in our territories to go for what we need. It is like knowing which store to go to, hardware, grocery, or pharmacy. We have always used our territories for subsisting, hunting, gathering, fishing. As young children, we learn plant names and uses. Then we learn the skills to use them in a respectful way. Many of the lands we subsist on are now held by private companies. These lands were once rich forests, providing for our people since time immemorial, but now have been destroyed by forestry, residential, commercial developments. We used to hunt and gather plants at a place called Peat Palm. It is now a subdivision and recreation area. It is closed for hunting and gathering plants. If we go there, we would be trespassing. Another development at Walker's Hook involved a major desecration where a fish hatchery put their affluent into a Mukwela, a burial place where approximately 1,200 of our ancestors are buried. Who else would get away with desecrating cemeteries? Why do our rights go ignored? Why do our rights go disregarded? Development can stop our plants and medicines from growing. Once lands are developed for housing or commercial purposes, we are unable to access them. We have been threatened, blockaded, and even arrested. I have witnessed development sprawl across our territories at an alarming rate, with very serious consequences for our health, meaning people, and the environment. Our territories have suffered. Many of our villages had to be moved because the forest companies used the rivers to transport logs and flooded our villages. Kwaisit. Kwaisit is a special physical, emotional, spiritual cleansing ceremony away from people. The bathing site must be clean, pure, and private, pristine. Logging and development in the territory has drastically affected our ability to quiet it. Our bathing sites are destroyed. Some people get sick if they can't quiet it. Clear cutting has destroyed many cultural sites. Historically, it would take forest companies several months to clear cut areas that now can be harvested in a few days. Our forests are not given enough time to mature fully, as you can see in that picture. I can see the trees being cut early. I am concerned that our territories cannot withstand this, as it is unsustainable for the environment and our activities and needs. Rain, runoff. Runoff is a major problem in logged out areas. Once forests are clear cut, trees that held the soil and gravel in place are no longer there for support, so the mountainside can yet at them or slide down, often into the rivers and streams. I can see in pictures B and D photos of where the mountainside can slide into the river or creek. I have seen it happen. The clear cuts result in loss of habitat for animals and plants. Even when wildlife patches are left there, there are no homes for animals, elk, deer, bear, or birds. The animals try to hold up in a place like this, but they'll starve. When it gets cold, there's no wind protection, and they will freeze. I have gone to places like this, and I have seen many animal carcasses there. Picture E for clear-cutting practices that destroy animal habitat. There were little patches there where animals try to hold up. They starve and freeze in there. We live in fear of signs. Private property. No trespassing. Trespassers will be prosecuted. We live with the threat of being arrested. I try not to be afraid and go there to harvest plants. I have to. We need these plants for medicines and food. They are becoming very scarce. Access is a very serious problem on private land. The workers of a forest company kicked me and my family off our property. We were told we were trespassing. We live in fear of arrest or harm when we attempt to continue our traditional lifestyle in our own territory. This affects our culture and people. We have difficulty carrying out our ceremonies, harvesting wood, medicines, food, hunting, bathing, or fishing in our own territories. These have serious consequences for the health, strength, spirituality, and survival of our Halkmenian people. The struggles we face are chisel, very frightening. I thank the members of the commission for giving us the opportunity to tell you about the destruction of our ancestral lands and our Halkmenian way of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucien. In conclusion, as Lucien's testimony makes clear, it's the present-day results of Canada's uncompensated expropriation of virtually all the Halkmenian traditional territory that have been disastrous and frightening for the people and have caused irreparable harms to their property and other human rights protected under the American Declaration. The HCG underscores the point is made throughout these proceedings. This case is not complex. It doesn't establish any new precedents or novel interpretations of the American Declaration. All the Halkmenian simply ask is for the Commission to apply the well-reasoned norms and principles of its jurisprudence respecting the OAS member states' duties to protect and safeguard Indigenous peoples' property and other human rights in ancestral lands to the Government of Canada. In conclusion, just summarizing quickly our requests for relief, which are detailed much more in our submissions, the HCG asks the Commission to request that Canada establish a legal mechanism to delimit, demarcate, and title Halkmenian ancestral lands. Canada relies on the argument that there are overlaps. Yes, indeed, there are overlaps. In fact, many of our amicus, one of our amici today, Chief Doug Wife from Sonaimo, is one of those overlapping claims. The AFN and the First Nations Summit, which represent all of the tribes that Canada names as overlaps, have filed amicus briefs. Quite frankly, it's a distraction, the overlap issue. The Commission's jurisprudence and the Inter-American jurisprudence makes absolutely clear, as well as the Commission's recent report on ancestral lands at paragraph 115, that the overlap issue is no excuse for failing to protect the property rights and other human rights of the Indigenous peoples in their property. The state must make flexible accommodation. If the state wants to sit down and resolve the overlap issue so that we can establish a system of prior consultation and prior consent, I can assure you that the First Nations that are in that overlap area would be glad to do it, to stop this activity right now. If Canada is not willing to demarcate title Halkmenian lands, then they must provide restitution, again, as outlined in the Commission's jurisprudence. And finally, and most importantly, we realize these issues are complex. We realize that there are over 198 First Nations involved in treaty negotiations. We understand that. However, the jurisprudence of this commission is absolutely clear. Canada must provide for prior consultation and prior free and informed consent before any of these activities which destroy the ability of the Hulkuminin peoples to practice their culture, to worship on their lands, to live as they have always lived as indigenous peoples, that obligation is absolutely assured by the American Declaration and the decisions of this commission. The Hulkuminin people have asked me to extend their special thanks to the commission. In 1884, the Hulkuminin chiefs traveled to the King of England and told him, 1907, and the king said something as would be done. We're still waiting. And this is the first time the Hulkuminin have had the ability to present their case, and we thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I would like to ask the representatives of the State of Canada to make their response also for 20 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jane Arbour, and I am counsel for the Government of Canada. With me today are Ambassador Alan Cullum, directly to my right, Douglas Janoff, also from the Permanent Mission of Canada to the Organization of American States, Mr. Frank Soda, a Director of Negotiations for the Government of Canada, and my co-counsel, Dan Moore. Canada's oral presentation, like its written submissions, presents the views of both the Government of British Columbia and the Government of Canada. In the time available today, it is not possible to address all the issues raised by this petition. Canada, therefore, continues to rely on all its written submissions. The petition brought by the Hulkuminin Treaty Group raises issues that implicate negotiations under the BC Treaty Commission in Canada. This petition, which examines the rights of the HTG under the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, also affects the interests of many other First Nations and many non-Indigenous persons in British Columbia. This petition raises issues of great importance to all Canadians, the reconciliation of Indigenous rights with the sovereignty of the Canadian state. The BC Treaty process is a process of confidential, interest-based negotiations. The confidentiality of negotiations, which is so important to creating a space in which settlements can be crafted, creates a certain difficulty for all of us, as it is not possible to give the Commission a full understanding of the state of play at the HTG treaty table. While Canada cannot discuss specifics, the parties to the HTG treaty table have recently met and have resumed negotiations. Another preliminary point for Canada is in regard to the amicus briefs that have been filed in support of this petition. Canada has not attempted to address directly many points raised in these briefs. Much of what is raised there is not relevant to the situation of the HTG. More disturbing, however, is the presence of misinformation and hyperbole in these briefs. Canada asked the Commission not to give undue weight to untested and therefore questionable statements contained in these briefs. The focus of Canada's presentation today is certain specific aspects of three broad areas of inquiry: the functioning of the BC treaty process, the process of litigation in Canada, and the allegations in the petition. Mr. Soda, who is the Government of Canada's Director of Negotiations for the Vancouver Island region, the area we're talking about, will address aspects of the BC treaty process.
Thank you very much, Jane. Mr. President, members of the panel, Hulkuminin chiefs, and other representatives, modern treaty making in Canada is a big undertaking. Just take a look at the larger of the two maps which were provided to you. This map shows that more than 100% of the landmass of British Columbia is claimed by First Nations. The aim of the BC treaty process is a negotiated resolution of the outstanding First Nation land claims in British Columbia. Negotiations under the BC treaty process are comprehensive, complex, and dynamic in nature, and they must address the rights and interests of the parties to the treaty, as well as other First Nations and non-Aboriginal members of Canadian society. Each of the agreements negotiated under the BC treaty process has required significant effort and dedication from each of the parties to ensure the negotiations provide win-win results that balance the interests of all Canadians. Modern treaties in Canada are not historic treaties. They contain many more components. Modern treaties in Canada are comprehensive. They're comprehensive documents that set out First Nations treaty rights and benefits. They include self-government, culture and heritage, fisheries and wildlife harvesting, environmental assessment and management rights, and of course, they also include land and cash. Canada refers the Commission to the Manulf Final Agreement. This is the most recent treaty concluded. For the breadth of issues and negotiations negotiated by the parties, you will see in the table of contents of this document the scope of a modern treaty. The text and appendices contain the details that needed to be worked through in order to reach a treaty with the Manulf First Nations. The Manulf Treaty provides the five member First Nations with a population of approximately 2,000 people with land and cash valued at approximately $500 million, half a billion dollars. Under the treaty, over 24,500 hectares of land on Vancouver Island were transferred in fee simple to the Manulf First Nations. Canada notes for the Commission that private lands were purchased for inclusion in the Manulf Treaty. Canada asks the Commission to appreciate that while modern treaty making in Canada takes time, settlements are being realized. All the parties have learned that it does take time to achieve a comprehensive and enduring settlement. Even so, there is momentum at many negotiating tables, including the Halkominum table. On October 12th of this year, the BC Treaty Commission released its annual report, which is the red booklet provided earlier to you. The report refers to 60 First Nation groups which have engaged in this voluntary process since 1992. Of the 42 First Nations which are currently actively negotiating, 15, or more than one-third, are in advanced negotiations. That means that they are nearing conclusion of an agreement in principle, nearing conclusion of a final agreement, or in fact have concluded a final agreement. I would like now to address the specific issue of the size of the negotiation loans and the timing of the repayment of these loans. When the BC treaty process was established, First Nations, British Columbia, and Canada agreed that loans and contributions should be made available to First Nations in order to create a level playing field amongst the parties. An annual funding budget is established by Canada and British Columbia, which comprises up to 80% loans and 20% non-repayable contribution funding. The independent BC Treaty Commission is responsible for allocating this annual funding to individual First Nations based on the First Nations' proposed negotiation work plan. Neither Canada nor British Columbia is involved in the decision of how much each First Nation receives from the BC Treaty Commission. Loans under the BC treaty process are repayable upon successful conclusion of a final agreement. This repayment is offset from the cash component of a settlement. If a First Nation voluntarily chooses to withdraw from the treaty negotiation, the loan becomes payable. However, to this point, Canada has not initiated collection measures in such circumstances. Another specific issue which arises due to the fact that modern treaty negotiations are multi-year initiatives is what happens in the interval during which negotiations proceed. Time does not stand still for First Nations involved in treaty negotiations. The governments of Canada and British Columbia provide significant benefits to First Nations both within and outside the treaty process. For example, Canada provided annual funding to the HTG member First Nations last year in the amount of approximately $54 million. Federal funding for all First Nations includes money for economic development, education, governance, health care, housing, income assistance, infrastructure, and public works. This funding is not a loan. It is a cash transfer to First Nations so they can provide programs and services to their members living on their lands. The government of British Columbia engages First Nations on matters that fall within provincial jurisdiction, whether they're taking part in the BC treaty process or not. British Columbia has and continues to negotiate a range of agreements to address First Nations' varied interests and make progress towards reconciliation while recognizing that one size does not fit all. These agreements include, but are not limited to, 1, incremental treaty agreements that flow treaty benefits, including land, to First Nations in advance of the conclusion of a treaty, 2, agreements that provide First Nations with a share of government revenues generated from resource development in their asserted traditional territory. 3, agreements that protect areas of cultural significance. And 4, agreements that provide for First Nations participation in resource management decisions on Crown lands within their asserted traditional territories. As treaty negotiations are being pursued, a First Nation's asserted rights are taken into consideration by the federal and provincial governments through a consultation and accommodation. Governments in Canada consult and, where appropriate, accommodate First Nations on matters that may adversely impact their interests or rights. Canada recognizes that consultation is important for good governance and sound policy development and decision-making. We have strong consultation processes in place. Canadian court decisions have stated that such processes are a matter of law. So the result is, if Halkominum does not want to pursue the treaty process, they don't have to. They can pursue the protection of their asserted rights through litigation in the courts, or in the event that major activities are taking place on Crown lands, through consultations and accommodation processes. I would like to conclude my comments by quoting Sophie Pierre, Chief Commissioner of the BC Treaty Commission's 2011 annual report, the red booklet in front of you. Treaties will bring a $10 billion cash injection, new investment in jobs, and a better future for First Nations and all British Columbians. Ultimately, it is a responsibility of the governments of Canada, British Columbia, and First Nations to answer the question, how can we realize a significant return on the investment we have made in treaty making in British Columbia? We believe the answer is straightforward: to recommit to treaty making, ratify final agreements and agreements in principles, and resolve the overlaps on shared territory. Success in these areas will ensure there is a return on investment the parties have made in the BC treaty process over the past 19 years. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Frank. The governments of Canada and British Columbia remain committed to participating in the BC treaty process as negotiations offer the best avenue for resolution of the outstanding land claims in British Columbia that also allow the parties to address so much more than just the question of the land. Canada recognizes, however, that not all First Nations want to negotiate a settlement at this time. Another option available to all First Nations is to turn to the courts for a judicial determination of the extent of their asserted Aboriginal rights. In 1982, during an important time of constitutional renewal for the Canadian state, a powerful provision for the protection of the rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada was placed in our Constitution. Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982 protects both Aboriginal and treaty rights for the First Nations of Canada. Aboriginal rights are the rights of the Indigenous peoples of Canada that are described in our common law. Since 1982, Canadian courts have been developing tests to describe these rights. Aboriginal rights can encompass a variety of things, including land ownership or Aboriginal title, various rights to the use of land for hunting, fishing, gathering, cultural and spiritual practices, various rights not tied to specific land, and governance rights. Many existing Aboriginal rights, however, are inchoate, not yet fixed in law for the particular First Nation, because the courts have yet to be asked to determine if many given First Nations in fact have the rights they claim. Treaty rights are those rights of the Indigenous peoples of Canada that have been set out in a treaty between the First Nation and the relevant governments. These rights can be found in both historic and modern domestic treaties. The content and scope of treaty rights are determined by the parties. Modern treaties in particular contain a wide variety of rights. In order to describe the impact of the courts in Canada for the protection of Indigenous rights, and therefore the viability of the litigation option for First Nations, Canada notes for the Commission that litigation on Indigenous rights in Canada can address either domestic treaty rights or the duty to consult Indigenous peoples concerning their treaty or Aboriginal rights, or the content and scope of their Aboriginal rights. Canada's submissions have attempted to explain that First Nations who have pursued litigation have a good record of success in respect of the litigation of their treaty rights or the challenge to the adequacy of government consultation. Canada's presentation today focuses only on Aboriginal title litigation, litigation in which a First Nation seeks a determination by the Canadian courts of the scope of its asserted rights to the ownership of land. The efficacy of Aboriginal title litigation in Canada is highly relevant to the outcome of this petition. The HTG are alleging that Canada is violating its property rights under the American Declaration. The HTG also claim a large area of land on Vancouver Island as its ancestral territory. They allege, the HTG, that it is not possible to obtain protection for these land rights in Canadian courts. Canada does not agree with these allegations. Canada defends the work of its independent courts. What the Commission needs to appreciate, an appreciation that can be gained by reading the very long decisions themselves, is why Aboriginal title litigants to date have been unable to prove Aboriginal title in the large areas that they claim as their ancestral territory. In the Roger William case, as one example, the inability of the plaintiff First Nation to prove its Aboriginal title related to the all-or-nothing approach that was taken. The court in that case concluded it could not issue a binding declaration recognizing Aboriginal title to the entire area claimed. The trial judge noted his sense that the claimants had Aboriginal title to some portion of the larger territory they claimed, but their case, because the claimants had taken this all-or-nothing approach, had not permitted him to determine from the approach they took the location or extent of their title. Canada asserts that a properly brought case with proof that adequately supports the claim will succeed in a Canadian court. Canada further asserts that neither the HTG nor its member First Nations have pursued their claims to Aboriginal title in a Canadian court. Canada maintains that it is no answer for the HTG on the merits of their claim before this petition to point to the inability of a few First Nations to succeed on their claims in a Canadian court. Canada, as Canada has noted in its submissions, the key to the allegations of violations of the American Declaration in this petition appears to be the allegations in respect to the right to property. In essence, the HTG alleges that Canada must demarcate the land contained in its claim to ancestral territory, and that it should have done so long ago. All other allegations of the petitioner flow from this central issue. Canada takes issue with all aspects of the petition. A key element of its defense, however, is the large gap between what the HTG claim is their property or ancestral territory on the one hand, and on the other hand, what in fact are the property rights of the HTG. In its submission dated October 12, 2011, Canada noted that the member First Nations have reserve lands, which are set aside for their sole use and benefit. In the time since Canada joined the Organization of American States, there have been no takings of land from the HTG or any of their member First Nations. The HTG assert a large portion of land taken up in the 1880s is their ancestral territory. This claim to ancestral territory exists as a basis for negotiations under the BC Treaty process, as it was identified by the HTG in their statement of intent, which is part of that process in the early stages. This claim has also been asserted before the Commission in this petition. This claim has never been proven. It has never been subjected to a determination by a domestic decision maker. As you can see from the smaller of the two maps that we handed out to you today, more than 75% of the land asserted by the HTG to be the ancestral territory of its member First Nations is also subject to claims asserted by 18 other First Nations. The map shows the overlapping claims within the BC Treaty process, and it demonstrates this fact that we are presenting today. While Canada acknowledges that the member First Nations of the HTG may have outstanding Aboriginal rights, including Aboriginal title rights, and Canada is seeking a resolution of these asserted claims, in a negotiated settlement, Canada does not accept the scope of the HTG's claim to ancestral territory. Canada does not accept the so-called HTG Atlas can in any way be seen as proof of the extent of the ancestral territory of the HTG. The entire Atlas is based on the boundaries drawn by the HTG for the purposes of negotiations. The entire Atlas is therefore based on an unproven assertion. Moreover, it is not at all clear whether the details contained in the many maps in that Atlas refer solely to the ancestors of the member First Nations of the HTG, or to the ancestors of the much larger Coast Salish Indigenous people, whose descendants make up many other First Nations on Vancouver Island in addition to the HTG. Moreover, on any reasonable review of the details in that Atlas, there is no support in that Atlas for the extent of the asserted claim. In conclusion, if I may, Canada notes that the petition brought by the Holkaminam Treaty Group raises issues that implicate all treaty negotiations within the BC treaty process, and indeed land claims in other parts of Canada, potentially. Canada affirms the strong will of both the Government of British Columbia and the Canadian Government to continue striving with the HTG for a settlement of their claims through the BC treaty process. Canada remains optimistic that comprehensive settlement can be achieved. Canada asks the Commission to find that Canada has not violated the rights of the HTG to property, to cultural rights, to freedom of religion, to equality or due process as protected under the American Declaration. Thank you.
I'd like to thank both the petitioners and the government for their presentations. As the rapporteur on the rights of Indigenous peoples, you're probably not surprised I have a lot of questions. And some of these may actually be in the boxes of materials that are that I'm working my way through on this matter. We also have here the rapporteur for Canada. So let me begin and run through these quickly, and please feel free to submit answers in writing or tell me that it's in what you've already submitted, if that's appropriate. My first question has to do with the status of the domestic treaties, as you call them, in Canadian law. Can they be changed by subsequent state or federal legislation, or are they of constitutional rank? in other words, what guarantees are there for the future if these domestic treaties are signed? And I say that as someone who's looked at the consequences of U.S. treaties with Native Americans. secondly, a number of other common law jurisdictions have recently revised, or the courts have rethought some of the traditional doctrines about Native title, and I think particularly of Australia and the Mabo decision. And I'm wondering whether the courts in Canada have similarly sort of re-looked at the idea of original acquisitions or early claims over Indigenous lands in the way that the court did in the Mabo decision. Thirdly, you made a mention that the government has not collected or tried to collect as yet any of the loans that have been made for this process, and I'm wondering if that is a policy of non-collection or if that is simply a deferral to a later time of making a decision on that part. in respect of the kinds of financial assistance that you mentioned, I think you said $54 million, do you view that as a form of reparations, or is that just simply a part of the government policy generally? So those are my questions. I'll ask the country rapporteur if he has any. Are you the country? No? You're the country rapporteur. Yes.
Sí, gracias. Comisionada Presidenta, agradezco también las respectivas presentaciones de ambas partes. Y evidentemente, pues a reserva de ver con, de estudiar con detenimiento toda la información que se han servido presentar por escrito, la que en su oportunidad también aporten para el estudio del para la, el informe de fondo de este asunto. Yo quisiera aprovechar esta oportunidad para formular un par de preguntas a cada una de las partes. Y evidentemente ya algún aspecto se ha mencionado, pero también puede ser en su oportunidad por escrito, reitero. Le consultaría en primer lugar al Estado si existe una, si estiman que existe una diferencia jurídica entre el concepto de propiedad privada y propiedad ancestral de los pueblos indígenas. Y en caso de que se considerara que existe una diferencia, si estimaría que las tierras ancestrales de pueblos indígenas, en general, que se lleguen a enajenar sin consulta a los pueblos que lo habitan, continuarían siendo tierras ancestrales que podrían anteponerse a los titulares de propiedad privada adquirida. Y en cuanto a los peticionarios, también les consultaría si a partir de la década de los 90 del siglo pasado, ¿qué actividades continuaron llevando a cabo en el territorio que estiman ocupado por terceros y con qué frecuencia llevaron estas actividades en su caso? Y si bien ya han mencionado algunos aspectos, ¿de qué manera estimarían que la enajenación de sus tierras presuntamente ancestrales han afectado su integridad cultural? Sí, gracias.
Muchas gracias. Yo voy a hacer una serie de preguntas tanto al Estado como a los peticionarios. La primera pregunta es si en Canadá el derecho reconoce la propiedad de los pueblos indígenas sobre sus territorios ancestrales como una categoría propia, o si se considera otra forma de propiedad privada. La segunda pregunta es que nos informen qué acciones y procedimientos existen en el sistema judicial canadiense para resolver los reclamos de tierras por parte de los pueblos indígenas y las reparaciones económicas. También preguntaría a los peticionarios si se han intentado esas acciones dentro del sistema judicial y si consideran que esas acciones son adecuadas e idóneas para el respeto a sus derechos. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Before I give an opportunity to both sides to reply, I'd just like to make an offer. Next week, the Commission will preside over the signing of a friendly settlement on a major Indigenous land claim involving another of the member states. And we expect that will be followed by yet another. So it is something that we are very interested in facilitating. If there's at any point in the discussions between the group and the government that you think that the Commission could play a constructive role, we certainly offer ourselves to participate in the negotiation process to try to facilitate some resolution of this. I think our experience thus far has been, at least in this past year and a half, has been very positive in that regard. So with that in mind, we have about 10 minutes, so I'll give 5 minutes to the petitioners and 5 minutes to the government.
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner. There's a lot to go through. I won't go through, but I think I'm trying to understand the gist, the substance of all the questions. First of all, in the friendly settlement, we have asked either formally or through email communications at least a half a dozen times since the beginnings of these proceedings to engage in friendly settlement. We actually think that the Commission's expertise and the awareness of the norms would help tremendously. And so, again, we would immediately accept. We'll come next week if you like, whenever. Secondly, in response, I'll try to work backwards. Have actions been brought? A witness here, Luce Jean, referred to Walker's Hook and the desecration of burial grounds. That was an unsuccessful action that cost quite a bit of money. There have been several actions that have been brought over the years, and the experience has been lots of money spent on lawyers, and the government fails to implement the decision. We have amici briefs, and I disagree with the government. The amici are not relevant. The government cites, we specifically tried to get amici for the cases that the government cited, Chilcotin and others as well. And their experience confirms that litigation in Canadian systems cost anywhere from $15 to $20 million for Aboriginal title litigation. Let me say this, and the government admits it. There has never been a single instance in the history of Canada in which a Canadian court has recognized one square inch of Aboriginal title on either public or private lands. And that really is the issue here, and I'm glad the Commission is focusing on the private lands issue. In fact, there is a clear priority, there's a clear distinction in Canadian law between private lands and ancestral lands. Canadian courts have repeatedly held that Aboriginal title is fundamentally inconsistent with common law private title. Therefore, they will not engage in consultation. They certainly won't give prior consultation and free and informed prior consent. There's certainly no benefit sharing. The government refuses to appropriate. As for recognizing property rights, secondly, okay, so what activities? We have submitted extensive documents. I would hate to have you go back through all the affidavits from tribal members who can testify to contemporary actions on the land. The very gifts that have been given to me are used from the land. The cedar that you see, the affidavits specify. You see, here's what's unique. Because we have the three large landowners, this land has been largely undeveloped. It's really undergone intense development in the last 10 years. Part of that was brought on by the Olympics. Part of that was just brought on by the real estate boom. So these large areas of land that the Hulkuminam were able to leave their villages and go and collect medicines to hunt, to gather, to fish, what's happened is that they've been gobbled up. And so what you see are the pictures that we've shown you. They're basically disappearing. And because it's private lands, as these lands become clear-cut, it's an inevitable process. The trees are clear-cut. The timber companies sell off the bare land to real estate development. Golf courses, subdivisions go up, and they lose access. So that's what's unique, is the fact that such large areas were held by private companies that were not under intensive use, and the Hulkuminam had been allowed to use them. That's why they're here right now. And as for the government's BCTC treaty process, if you go through all those documents, we submitted, I believe, over 10 submissions on admissibility, and the Commission quite clearly and unequivocally stated that the BCTC process is not an effective remedy, and I'll summarize right here why it is not an effective remedy. The government refuses to engage in consultation on any developments that take place in private land on private lands. That's the issue here. And because such a large amount of this territory belonging to the Hulkuminam people's ancestral lands is controlled by the Big Three, there's no way the government's going to do that either. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your questions. Obviously, we can't answer them all, and some of them, at least one in particular, with respect to the Mabo decision, is really quite technical, and I'm afraid we'll have to answer that one for you in writing, and I hope I've understood it. We may have to ask for further clarification on that one. I'm going to turn to my colleague, Frank Soda, to talk about some of the first questions that you asked, Ms. Shelton.
Thanks, and we will also provide responses in writing to all of these and perhaps also seek clarification to make sure that I've understood the questions correctly. But thank you for those questions. So the first one is on the status of the treaties. Are they of constitutional rank? The answer to that is simple. Yes, they are. And can they be changed? Only if all three parties to the treaty agree, as set out in the amendment provisions, as you'll find in the Manolf final agreement that's there. The government can't change them unilaterally. On loans, the question, as I understood it, is it a policy of non-collection or a deferral? It's a deferral. Canada is responsible for overseeing taxpayer dollars, and the loans are a contractual agreement that is entered into between the First Nation and the BC Treaty Commission, and the terms are set out clearly there. The policy is of not to collect of withdrawal. There hasn't been any determinations of that, although there's been numerous cases where First Nations or governments have stopped treaty negotiations. There has been no collections ensued as of yet.
I'll just speak briefly to the question that I understood, and I'm sorry, sometimes the translations are not perfect, and I no comment on the translators, but it's just a reality that sometimes it's hard to catch the essence of the question. But with respect to what exists in Canada to determine Aboriginal title, there is a right of any First Nation to commence a case in a Canadian court to claim whatever area of land they claim as their land. And then they have to prove it. And what we've tried very briefly to explain today is that in the very few times when this has been tried, and these are massive cases, it takes a very long time to set out the proofs, to hear the witness of the elders, to look at the maps. At the end of the day, to date, the courts have been saying, well, you're asking us for this, but we don't see proof for this. And you're not helping us figure out where in all of this there is title. That is the problem that's been happening. The thing that you have to realize is the HTG haven't even tried to do that yet. They have never pursued a court case and stood before a judge with their proofs of that circle on the land that they're showing you in the HTG atlas and say, this is our land, and have a court say back to them, yes or no, or I can't tell, maybe some of it, we don't know. That has never happened. Okay? We do not know. And for that circle of land, there are at least 18 other First Nations who would hope to do the same thing, and they are also not in court. The other thing I would just like to observe is that it's very unclear what's going on in British Columbia, whether the land we're talking about is all now subdivisions or not. A lot of it is still mountains and trees, some of it clear-cut, some of it not. It's not all being gobbled up. That's the first thing. And the other thing is, I think I heard that the land is still being used by the Halkominum people. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much to everyone for your presentations today. It was very useful. Now, as I continue to work my way through all the documentation, I have some clear lines in mind as I read through all of what you have submitted. So thank you very much.